Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2014. Lecture 24, delivered on April 22, 2014. The title of this lecture is Review for Exam 2.
Today, Review for Exam 2. Exam 2 has a format identical to Exam 1, so this is like Season 2. Of the continuing saga of Game of Wrongs, or Game of Thrones. Well, let me go through the basics. Part one, multiple choice. Well, actually, I could put the exam up on the overhead if you'd like to see it. No, I don't think so. 20 questions, 2 points each. And I'll go back through these, obviously. And then part two is your workout problems. And there will be one, two, three, four of those. And I'll go through the fundamentals of those. And then part three is short written answers, little essays. Choose four of five, as you did on the first test. And I will be generous with my bullshit stamp this time. But we'll go back through these. Now, part one is always, it is the most difficult part because it can hit almost anything that I've covered in the class so far. So be on the lookout. Just a few of the things that I'll be touching on. Volatility, I'll ask you about volatility. What causes volatility? What causes operating leverage? What causes financial leverage? What causes the magnification of volatility from the sales line down to EBIT and then to net income? I will ask you some questions about bonds. The basics of bonds, essentially, what does it mean to be a debenture? What is the order of payment if the company goes bankrupt? From the mortgage bonds, senior, subordinated, junior subordinated, debentures, and all of that. How much a bondholder might get back at a specific level, like on the quiz, you saw one of those. Most of you got that. That was a little surprising. Sometimes that can get a little confusing. I tried to throw a curve at you, but you got it. Okay, also, I will ask you some basic questions about marginal cost of capital. Like, for example, I might say, well, what is the other name for the first tier of marginal cost of capital? Does anyone know? Say it. Okay, well, you get half the credit. Weighted average cost of capital. Yeah. Which one falls and which one rises when we're talking about MCC and IOS? Something like that might be on there. What is the order in terms of costliness of the component cost of capital? In other words, is internally generated equity more or less costly than externally generated equity? That would be a kind of question I could ask in that regard. I could ask you something basic about breakpoints. Save the big stuff for the workout problems on that. I could also ask you, well, preferred equity, is it more or less expensive than common equity? And if you're ever in doubt about cost, just relate back. What is the safety of this security versus another security? And, of course, something that is safer for the investor is going to have a lower cost to the company because the investor has more assurance of return. I'll also ask you some questions about public offerings. Make sure you know terms like tombstone, red herring, registration statement. And make sure you know what is a registration statement, what is a registration form as opposed to, let's say, an exemption from registration. I want to raise $5 million. Let's say I want to raise $5 million. Woman, I don't want to register this with the SEC. I want to use an exemption. Give me one or two that I could use. You got nothing? Got nothing. Sir, what do you say? Give me a couple of ways that I could raise $5 million without having to on selling common stock, but I wouldn't have to register the common stock to do it. Couldn't? No, you're. I mean, that was like saying peanut butter brownies, and not even in the same universe with the. Madam. Okay, let's try this. Sir, I'm going to raise $5 million, and I am not going to register it. The sale of the stock to get this $5 million in reliance on Regulation D-504. What say you to me?
You need a certain form for that.
No. Oh. You got to study this, okay? I'm going to go through the list with you here in a minute. You would say, go.
Oh, no, because you can only raise up to $1 million.
I love it when you talk like that. Later, dinner, dancing. You and me. Candles. Cheap ripple. Okay. Yeah. You can't. That is an exemption, but that's the $1 million exemption. You can raise up to $1 million without registering the stock in reliance on Reg D-504. That's the $1 million offering. If you don't want to register the security and you want to raise more than $1 million, you would have to rely on Reg D-505, Reg D-506, or Reg A, Regulation A. Those would be, and let me say them again. Reg D-504, you can raise up to $1 million without a full registration statement. Reg D-505 and Reg D-506, you can raise more than that without a registration statement. The difference is, though, that if you raise money with Reg D-504, as opposed to Reg D-505 and 506, there's something special about the stock. Do you remember what it is about Reg D-504s? See, if I raise $1 million, I could do 504, 505, or 506. But 504 has a couple of special things about it. One is I can do a general offering. I can sell it to anyone. 505 and 506, I have to use sophisticated or intelligent investors, which means I'd probably have to go outside of not selling Decatur. But, okay, 504 stock also is freely tradable, provided, you see, 505 and 506 and Reg A, those are restricted. What's the rule that is restricts stock sold in 505, 506, and Reg A? Anyone got it? Yes, 144. Rule 144, stock that you sell, generally speaking, if you don't register stock with the SEC before you sell it, then it's going to be restricted by Rule 144. In other words, you can't just buy and sell it in open stock markets. The exception is 504. You can raise up to $1 million, and that stock is actually freely tradable. It is not Rule 144 stock. So Rule 144, if all you need is $1 million, you probably wouldn't use 505 or 506. Well, there might be reasons why you would. But if you use 504, one, you don't have to do a registration statement. Two, it's freely tradable stock. That's the nice thing about 504. So again, $504 million offering up to $1 million you can do without registering it with the SEC. You still have to fill out a few forms and things like that for the states and all. 505 and 506, you also don't need a registration statement, but the stock is not freely tradable. It's restricted per Rule 144. Same with Regulation A. The story of a company, by the way, some years back, Regulation A, just to reinforce this in your mind. Reg A is actually kind of a popular way because you can pull a good amount of money. You can't go over a certain amount of money with Reg A, but you can raise some serious money. There was a company, a brewery, whose beer had become quite popular at the time. And they had this brilliant idea to raise money. They were going to sell stock, restricted stock. They were going to raise, I think, maybe $8 million. I think that was, I might be mistaken about this, but I think that was a cap on Reg A at the time. You could raise up to $8 million. So what they did was they put an offering circular, which is like a prospectus, except it's for these restricted offerings. They put an offering circular in every six-pack of their beer. They sold it in bottles. Every six-pack had an offering circular in it. And so you had all these, people buying their beer, drinking it. Oh, what the hell is, oh, they're selling stock. Well, goddamn, I'm so drunk, I'm going to buy some of it. And they sold tons of the stock through this incredibly intelligent marketing technique. Put the offering circular right in the product, and people bought it, and bought it, and bought it. And the company just kept raking in the money from this offering as people kept buying the stock. And unfortunately, that meant that they oversubscribed. They took in a lot of millions of dollars. And of course, then the SEC said, wait, you used an offering circular. You didn't register in reliance. In the offering circular, it says this is in reliance on Regulation A, which restricts the amount of stock that you can sell, the amount of money you can raise, and you raised multiples of that. Okay? Send it all back. And also pay a very hefty fine. You have to start over again. That was one of those too much of a good thing sort of deals. Registration statements. What are the two classic ways to register common stock? Woman? Got nothing, right? Nothing. Okay, sir, what would you say? Two classic ways to register common stock for a public offering. Form? Yes. Oh, God, yeah. So, pat him on the buttock. That was good. Yes, Form S-1. You're looking like, I got it. Yeah, Form S-1. And Form S-1 is to sell new common stock, IPO or a public offering of some kind. Form 10 you would use if you had issued stock in some kind of a restricted offering or stock some other way got out there and it's not registered. Form 10 is the way that you would register that kind of stock. Begin your life as a public corporation. You already have all of these private investors, and now you're going to make it so that their stock is registered and therefore qualifies for trading. That's the Form 10. There are a couple of minor offerings, too. The SB1, not minor, I shouldn't say. There are a little bit smaller offerings, the Form SB1, the Form SB2. Those are out there, too. What is it called if I register a huge amount of stock, but I don't sell all of it right away? I sell it in increments as I need equity capital. What's that called? Does anyone know? Say it. Shelf registration. That's a shelf registration. You register a pile of stock, put it on the shelf, and pull off chunks of it as you need equity. That's a shelf registration. I want you to know all these kinds of terms. Okay. There is one and only one selling document for a public offering, a public offering of registered common stock. What is the selling document called? That's right. The prospectus. Now, there is a preliminary version of the prospectus which you can hand around, but you can't sell stock with it. What's that called? The red herring. And they call it the red herring because it looks like a prospectus except that some of the lettering is red in it, on the especially on the front page. A red herring is a prospectus that you can't use to sell with because it's before the offering can be done. The SEC says this is the date when you can start your offering. Before that date, you have your prospectus, but you have to put red lettering on it saying you can't buy with this. You have to wait. But here's the selling document, except it's not a selling document yet because the SEC hasn't said go. You have that quiet period where you have to stay calm. Now, there's an announcement of a public offering that tells the company what kind of security is being sold, the price per share preliminarily, and the syndicate that's going to sell it. And at the top of this, it says this is neither an offer to sell nor a solicitation for an offer to purchase the securities noted herein. What the hell was that? Anyway, what is that thing called? You see it in newspapers like Wall Street Journal. Tombstone. That's the tombstone. Sort of like the pizza, except not as delicious. Good. These are the kinds of questions that I could go back and forth with. It's just memory work, but you have to make sure that you have it in order. It's kind of stuff that probably works on flashcards and stuff like that. And there's other stuff I could ask you about offerings, but that'll be in the multiple guests section quite a bit. Now, I'm going to ask you, in the workout problems, I'm going to have you do an internal rate of return and a net present value in the workout problem. But I can ask you some things about those in the multiple choice section. You found that the internal rate of return is 5.00%. I'd given you this cash flow for this project, and I'd walked away. I said, I'll tell you what to do with it later. So you, being an ambitious young go-getter, you worked out the internal rate of return right away. Okay? So I come back the next day. Oh, by the way, I need you. You found that the internal rate of return was 5%. Okay, so I say, work out for me, and you can answer me later. Work out for me if this is project is a go or a no-go, and I want you to use a discount rate of 6.5%. Instantly, what do you say? Or not instantly. I would give up on the computer right now. It ain't going to help you on that test. What, woman, what do you say? You're looking like, oh, for God's sake. Okay, you found an IRR of 5%. Now, what I want you to do is apply a discount rate to the cash flows to find NPV. And I gave you a discount rate of 6.5%. What say you?
Project.
Why?
Because that's way too high.
That's right, finance breath. That is exactly right. You see, the internal rate of return was the point where NPV went from positive to negative. So at anything above 5%, that line is down on the other is down in the dirt somewhere, prowling around. So I could do something like that. That's almost a gimme. Just remember, if you find an IRR, any discount rate above that IRR is going to make a negative NPV project. That means no. Any discount rate that I give you above that, rather below that IRR, that's going to be a positive NPV project. Just because that line goes from positive to negative, and the point that where it breaks is right there at the IRR. Yeah.
Would you be able to do an IRR problem? An example problem?
Yeah, I can give you one right now. Okay. Now break out your calculators. As a matter of fact, you have a project that will cost up front $40,000. With a life of 5 years and a salvage value of $2,000. The incremental cash flows are as follows. Year one, when the project's just coming off the ground, $5,000. You'll get in the door. Years two and three, $12,000. Year four, $10,000, and year five, $6,000. Part A. If you discount the cash flows at 6.8%, what is the NPV, net present value? Part B, what is the internal rate of return? Now, this is just a calculator exercise. So make sure you have your calculator with you, and it should just fall right out. For the NPV, you're going to say Apps Finance 7, which is NPV. Again, Apps Finance 7. And I'll bring you back to the main screen with the NPV. Now, don't forget the order. With NPV, you're going to put in the interest rate first as a percent. Don't do the decimal. In real math, we use decimals, obviously. But with the calculator, they want just the percentage. So in this one, what did I say? 6.8. You just type in 6.8. Comma. Negative 40,000. Put that little negative sign and then key in 40,000. Comma. Open braces. That second parenthesis. And that opens the braces. In braces, you always put the cash flow, the positive cash flow, okay? Just keep that in mind. But don't forget a comma before it. Everything has to have a comma to tell the calculator something new is about to happen. Okay, so now in the braces, you're going to put in 5,000, comma, 12,000, comma, 12,000, comma, 10,000, comma, 8,000. Do not put in 6,000, it's 8,000. Don't forget the salvage value. Okay, honestly, when I have this problem every time, and the only mistake people make is they forget to put in the salvage. It's 8,000 on year five. Okay, close the braces, second close parenthesis, close the parenthesis, and hit enter. And what do you get?
-1503.
Oh, dang. -1500.
-3.
Do these just to the dollar for me, okay? I won't kill you if you do the cents, but make it easy on yourselves. This is the exception, okay? Now, so tell me, when I have you do the internal rate of return, is the internal rate of return going to be more or less than 6.8? It's going to be less, because at 6.8, the NPV line had already dug into the pay dirt. So the internal rate of return has got to be back down from 6.8. Now, you want to see a trick to do the IRR? Save you a little time. I want you to hit second entry. Second entry. Did you do that? And it comes back up, right? Now, go up, take the cursor up to the NPV, that little NPV thing. Take it up there. Now hit Apps, Finance, 8. And you'll see that it comes back to IRR. Do you see that? Now go over and delete the 6.8 comma. Just hit del, del, del. Go down to the bottom and hit Enter. Did it work? No, my ass. Okay. What do you mean, no? It should have. Huh?
Doing that on my calculator, at least it rewrites the negative sign with the IR.
No, do that again. Let me see. Hit second enter.
I gotta redo it.
Okay. What did you get for the IRR? It should have been about 5.4%. 5.4 what? Now you can just re-enter it. Don't forget, when you do IRR, there's no percentage because it's finding the percentage. Okay, now let me watch you do it.
Well, okay. I can do it right.
Oh, you're already. You're already on IRR.
So I go like that, and I delete it.
Well, that you were on IRR when
no,
you
I
did
know.
That.
I know, but like when
let
I
me
do
try
this,
something. Let me
it
try
just
something.
The minus
okay. Okay. Apps, finance. I just want to know this for my own purposes here. Okay, 6.8, comma, negative. 40,000, comma, open braces, and what was my cash flow? It was 5,000. I want to make sure of something 12, here. 5,000, comma, 12,000, comma, 12,000, comma, 10,000, comma, 8,000, close parenthesis, brace, close parenthesis. Okay, now, let's try it. Okay, apps, oh, wait, second entry. Now you take it back up, you take it over to the NPV. Okay, apps, finance, 8.
Oh, it just replaces?
Yeah,
okay.
That's all you do.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then you just delete.
I deleted the NPV, I think that's what other people did.
No, don't delete it. Yeah, if you're going to use the trick, don't delete the NPV. Just put the cursor on it, and it will be replaced. Yeah. At the last year, because essentially we're assuming all cash flows occur at the end of the year, and at the end of this fifth year, you finish the project, you get your last cash flow, and then you sell the equipment the same day. That it's a simplifying assumption, but it doesn't really hurt too much. But yeah, always on the last year. Unless I were to say that you actually get the payment the year before that, but that would be weird. Okay, but now you see. Yeah. I would throw this project out. I would reject it.
Why?
Because the net present value is negative. It's a negative NPV project. Just right there, that's the end of it. Now, let me go on here, clean up some other stuff. Okay, part two. Let me get to part two. You will have a problem posted late tonight, maybe 10 o'clock or so, and that problem will, you work it out. Don't suffer in silence and then see the problem on the exam and say, oh my God, it's there for you to get it done. It's the marginal cost of capital problem, MCC. You'll have it tonight. Now, the reason I do this is there are some things in this course that are just too long for an exam to just do them. And obviously on our first exam, that those calculating those volatility CVs was like that. On this, and also getting all the ratios calculated. On this one, the MCC just takes just enough time that it's better if you have the time to just work it out. And I always use a problem that is actually maybe a variation on a real company's project analysis. This will be a traditional one. You're going to have the availability of debt, and there will be two tiers. There will be cheap debt and then expensive debt. Remember your component costs of capital. Your component costs of capital are your first level of debt after taxes will be 1 minus your tax rate times, 1. Really? Try it. Keep trying this. 1. And that will be your first question. What's your first tier of after-tax cost of debt? Then you're going to have another level of debt at a higher interest rate. So you'll have to calculate that after-tax cost of debt, which will be 1 minus the tax rate, quantity times D2. And then you're going to have your cost of internally generated equity. In other words, this is the cost of your profit. Because you've got that money that you made at the bottom line, and so it is a cost to you because you can do something with it. And so there's an opportunity cost to having that. And that would be D1 over the current price of the stock plus the growth rate. Now remember, it's D1, so whatever the dividend is now, you have to grow it by 1 period. Remember that. And watch carefully. I might tell you what the dividend is 1 period from now, or I might tell you the dividend that they've just issued. The company has just issued a 10-cent share per share dividend on 1 million shares of common stock outstanding, something like that. And then, get that over there on the board. You'll have your cost of new equity, which would be D1 times the price of the stock now minus how much you would have to pay brokers to raise that. So I could say the brokerage fee is 7%. So you would have to take the current price of the stock times 0.93 to get the denominator. Again, follow that. If I said that the float is 7% and the price, let's say, is $50 or whatever, you would have to take the current price times 0.93 because that's all you get. You don't get 7% of it. You've lost money right off the bat by having the brokers do the work for you. So don't forget to do that minus the float. I usually give it to you as a percentage, usually. Plus G. Don't forget your plus G. And again, don't forget. The only real mistake I see in this problem, it has a real high scoring rate on this exam. The only place where usually people trip is right here. They forget to use D1 instead of D0. Once you have done that, then you walk the breakpoints. And there'll be just two of them, breakpoint one and breakpoint two. And breakpoint one will be where the debt jumps. And I'm just going to write it here. The debt jump. Okay, this company can borrow up to $5 million. It's 3%. And then above $5 million, it has to pay 5%. Your jump is at, what the hell? Was it $3 million? Over percent of debt in capital structure. So if they have, let's say they're 40% debt and 60% equity, you would divide that number, the debt jump, by 0.4. The equity jump, the best way for you to remember it, and this is a little bit more pedantic, more expanded than what I did in the lecture. Take their net income and take out the dividend, which they obviously wouldn't have for investment purposes. The total dividend. So if I issue a 10 cent per share dividend on 1 million shares, that would mean that you take the net income minus $100,000. If I had a net income, let's say, of $8 million, and I declared a 25 cent per share dividend on 500,000 share on 1 million shares, that would be 8 million minus 250,000. Make sure you take out the total dividend, and then you divide it by the percent of equity in capital structure. So in the 40-60, that one I just gave you, you would divide by 0.6. That's as clear as the formula can get. Breakpoint's done. The next step is the marginal cost of capital. MCC1, MCC2, and MCC3. All you do for these is you take the weight of debt times debt 1 after tax plus the weight of equity in the capital structure times the cost of existing common stock. So in other words, weight of debt 1 times KATD1 plus weight of equity times K sub S. Then you're going to jump and have to use expensive debt. So MCC2 is the weight of debt in your capital structure, like 40% or whatever, times debt 2 after tax, plus the weight of equity in your capital structure. You still got net income after dividends. You still got some of that in the bank, so you're going to keep using that. And finally, for MCC3, once you've used up all your cheap debt and all of your cheap equity stuff, then the last one is just going to be weight of debt times your expensive debt plus weight of equity times the cost of new equity, your expensive equity. So it's, if you remember it this way, this one, and then this one. For the MCCs. Don't forget to put your weights on them. Again, this one and this one, then this one and this one, and then this one and this one. Applying your weights. As long as you don't start thinking about what you're doing, you're fine. If you start thinking about what you're doing, you're dead. Okay? Now then, don't forget to put your IOS, lay them out from your highest ROI project to your lowest. And then what you're going to do is get your graph made. First thing you always do is put in your breakpoints. because that makes it easy to do your marginal cost of capital. You do your marginal cost of capital one, doing it properly scaled, up to breakpoint one. And then you do your marginal cost of capital two, up to breakpoint two. And then you do your marginal cost of capital three after that. That's all you do for that part. And then you do your IOS. My highest returning project, I'll take it out as far as it takes, like how much money I'd spend on that one. That would be your first project. And then from there, I graph at the proper ROI, my second project. And then I find my third project, always from the last one, because you've spent this money, now you can start spending money on the next one. Once you've spent the money on that one, you can spend money on the next one. And then your last one. You can label them A, B, and C if you want, and D. Make sure you give them the right names, though. Don't say, if I say, what projects should you accept? Don't write, I accept projects A and B, for God's sake. Tell me what projects it is. That's a warning. Don't do that. Okay, in this case, which projects do I accept? You see that? Only the projects that are all above their marginal cost of capital. You notice that C starts out, its ROI is above the marginal cost of capital at the start. But by the time you're finished with C, where the hell am I? The marginal cost of capital has gone up above it. So you say no to C because even though it started with an MCC, is how its MCC is actually below the ROI on the project. By the time you finish the project, you're using really expensive money for a project that doesn't return enough. And D, of course, just sucks like hell. It starts out bad, and it just doesn't get any better than that. That's how you do a marginal cost of capital problem. It'll be straight up like you've seen them before, and you just follow the rules. Yeah. Projects by cost. See, A costs this much,
right,
and then B costs this much, and you're marking them off by their ROIs down the line.
The
yeah, so A, you have done that horizontal line on the ROI of A. Then B, you're doing that one on the ROI of B. And then C, you're doing on the ROI of C. And then D, you're doing on the ROI of that one.
So are we calculating ROI, or is that giving?
No, I give the, oh, God, no. Hey, you know, that's a cool problem, though.
Uh-huh.
Everyone's like, shut up, noob. I could do that, but I'm not going to. It would basically be finding the IRRs of the projects. That would be one way you would probably do it. I don't know. But that's one way you could do it, I guess. Yeah. Are you okay? That one? You mean the MCCs? Here, let's try one. Okay, let's say that up to 800,000, you can borrow at 8%. Above 800,000 at 12%. The company's tax rate is 20%. Okay, we'll start with that. Now, let's do a couple of other things. Let's say that the dividend that they've just issued is 25 cents on, let's say, 10 million shares. That's D0. growth rate of the dividend, let's say it's going to grow at, let's say, 10% per year. Currently, the stock price right now is $40 per share. Net income for the year just ended, that's money that they have to for the equity for the shareholders, is $7,500,000. The float on new equity is 10%. In other words, they have to give the brokers 10%. See if I remember. Oh, yeah. And the capital structure is 40% debt. 40% debt, 60% equity. Now, I can guarantee you that I have no idea whether this will work out or not. Because I'm throwing the numbers out there from basically my ass. Okay, let's crank it. Your cost of debt after tax, debt one, is going to be 1 minus your tax rate times 8%, which is 6.4%. That'll be your first answer. In other words, you will get points on the test. You will not go home empty-handed. The cost of debt two, after tax, is going to be 1 minus 0.2 times 12%, which is 9.6%. Your expensive debt after tax will cost you 9.6%. The cost of profit the company makes is going to be D1, which is 25 cents per share times 1 plus the growth rate over the price per share of the stock, which is $40, and then you have to plus the growth rate back in. Now, for God's sake, someone do that calculation. That would be 27.5 divided by 40. I can do it. Got to stop relying on this calculator to do these, though. Okay. Clear. 0.275 divided by 40 equals... Wait. Is that right? Clear. 0.25 times 1.1 plus, or rather, divided by 40 equals plus 0.1. So that's 10.69%. And the cost of new equity is just going to be 0.25 times 1 plus 0.10 times $40. 10% float would be $4, right? If they have to give the brokers 10% of every share they sell, that would be $4. So working that one out, plus your growth rate, 0.275 divided by 36 plus 0.1. Is that all it is, 10.76%? No, because it's 10% float on $40. Did I say float was 10% of... So in other words, when a broker sells the stock for $40 a share, it keeps 10% of that. It keeps $4. So the company gets only $36. I got actually a pretty shallow number there. Did you get 10.76%? Okay, that's what happens when I pull a problem out of my butt like that. Okay, well, now we're ready to get the MC. Okay, break points. Breakpoint one. Okay, this company, $800,000 is its break on the debt divided by 40%. So that would be, working that out, survey says 800,000 divided by 0.4 buys me $2 million. So in other words, their first break point is at $2 million. Break point two, God, please let this work out. What was their net income, did I say? $7,500,000, but they paid a dividend. They paid a 25 cent per share dividend on 10 million shares. So they paid a dividend. In this case, what we'll have is they have $7,500,000 available, but they shot that much of it to the investors. 10 million shares times 25 cents per share, they shot back to the investors $2,500,000. And then we divide that by the share of equity. So there you go. 5 million divided by 0.6, yeah. 5 divided by 0.6 equals. So their next break point is at $8,333,333. There are your break points. Draw those in and make sure you use a ruler because it can get really tight. Now, marginal cost of capital 1 equals the weight of debt, 40%, times cost of debt 1, 6.4%, plus 60% times the cost of cheap equity, which was 10.69%. Your marginal cost of capital 2 is 0.4, weight of debt, times the cost of expensive debt, 9.6%, plus 0.60 times, you're still using your cheap equity, the stuff that you earned, and then your marginal cost of capital 3 is 0.40 times your expensive debt, plus 0.60 times your expensive equity, 10.76%. There you go. And no, I'm not even going to bother to calculate those. Then you graph those, you graph your IOS, and pretty much there's the end of the problem. You can see your choice of projects to accept or reject. Now you're all going to ace that problem, right? Now, going on, I will have you on part two. The other things that I'm going to have you be doing, I'll have you calculate a break even. That's pretty much easy. That's easy stuff. And then I'm also going to have you find a DOL, a DCL, and a DFL. Degree of operating leverage, degree of combined leverage, and a degree of, degree of operating leverage, degree of financial leverage, degree of combined leverage. Not hard. Just make sure you do your delta percents. Percent change in sales, percent change in EBIT, and percent change in net income, and then you're going to go on from there. That's about all there. It's just the three formulas. Yeah, you do have your formula card. Don't worry about that. Make sure you have that with you. Okay, now, let's get down to part three. Essays. Yeah. The debt break divided by the weight of debt and capital structure is your equity that's left after. See, they earned $7,500,000, so they could have invested that for projects, but they gave $2,500,000 of it away to their shareholders. So all they've got is $5 million. Divide that by 0.60 to see how far they can go with equity, mixing it with debt. Okay, here we go. Oh, one other thing in part two, I forgot. I'm going to have you do a problem where you tell me how much money would be used of what kind in different working capital management policies. So here's how it would work. I forgot, and I want to get that done. You got it, kind of, okay. Let's say a company has $5 million in fixed assets and $2 million in permanent current assets. Temporary current assets can be as much as $3 million. In other words, maybe like right before the Christmas season, you can have $3 million on top of the $2 million that seems to always be there in your current assets. What would be the maximum level of short-term financing under each policy? Conservative, moderate, aggressive. So in other words, this company's profile looks like this. Its fixed assets are $5 million. Its permanent current on top of that is $2 million, going up to $7 million. And then it has this temporary that comes and goes in a seasonal cycle that can reach as much as $3 million. So there are times during the year when the company's total assets reach $10 million, its current assets reach $5 million. That's what the profile of this company looks like, its asset side of its balance sheet, graphically. So now, how much should it use to, how much short-term financing should it use? The moderate is the easy one. The moderate is the no-brainer. In the moderate scenario, it'll just finance short-term assets with short-term financing. Okay, again, the moderate is the easy. It will finance short-term assets regardless with short-term financing. So the moderate, tell me, how much short-term financing will be in the moderate? Talk to me. Anyone got it? Let's try it again. You finance short-term assets with short-term liabilities. So how much short-term financing? Their current assets are from 5 to 10. That's $5 million. It's just straight up Current assets are current liabilities. It doesn't matter whether they're temporary or permanent or Jewish or Hindu, they are financed with short term. Now, the conservative uses long term for almost all of its stuff. It finances only a little bit with short term financing. In other words, when you look at its total assets, all of its assets, fixed and current, long-term assets and short-term assets, you will see that they finance with long-term most of it. Doesn't really matter, current, temporary, current, permanent. So in other words, when I ask you about the conservative, there is not an exact right answer, but there is a range of right answers. Madam, again, conservative, you finance almost everything long-term. You don't really do a lot of short-term financing. I don't want to know about temporary and permanent. All I know is that I want to finance most of my assets long-term. I don't like short-term financing. So give me a number a conservative would, management policy would call for short-term. Work it, girl. Give me a small number. Give me a small number. Just a small number.
Like 1 million?
Good. You're right. I thought you said you didn't know that. You see what happened there? 1 million. They don't like financing short term. So, you know, you do it. I mean, you have to do some. I mean, you have to borrow some money from me. But you really don't, you know, short term, but you really don't like to do that. So you could say, well, 3 million, 2 million, 1 million. But if you say 5 million, no, that's moderate. If you say 4 million, 3 million, 2 million, even a million, you could even say $500,000. I'd be a little bit edgy about that. That's awfully small short term financing, but that's okay. You see, because a conservative doesn't like short term. So even though those are temporary assets, a conservative working capital management policy would say, I really prefer that as much as we can, we borrow long-term, because long-term borrowing is cheaper. It's just cheaper. So a conservative is going to say, well, why don't we finance all of this with long-term? Because long-term debt's cheap. And maybe this little cap up here, we'll borrow on some commercial paper or whatever. But we're not going to do a lot of it. So you could give me an answer for the conservative. You could say 1 million. You could say 2 million. You could say 3 million. Or you could even say 4 million. And you would get the problem right. Because a conservative just doesn't want to use a lot. It certainly doesn't want, because if you say 5 million, no, that's moderate. That's moderate. But if you say anything below 5, don't even try 4,999,999. I will flunk your ass. Get it closer to that, okay? Now, an aggressive, you finance a lot short term because it gives you flexibility. So, again, you finance a lot of your assets, short term. So, what would be an answer that would be correct for an aggressive working capital management policy?
6 million.
Yeah? Give me a bit.
8 million.
Better. Yeah, yeah. Come on. You want to push it? Push it. Come on.
9.
Damn, boy. That's Butch. Do you even lift? Really? You see? You got the hang of it. That's all there is to it. Look, aggressive, this is young companies. They don't want to be burdened with long-term debt. They want to borrow, use as much as they can that's short-term stuff. They don't want to have lots of equity shareholder financing. They don't want to talk to bondholders who are going to be hanging around for 20 years looking at them. They want short stuff. You got it? I'm going to do a problem very similar to that on the test. Very similar. And so I'll make God, it's going to look almost so similar that if you get it wrong, I'll give you a wedgie. Now, let me get to the shorter essays. Here are some yeah. No, it's just all it is it's your short term is your current assets. Yeah, that's all. Don't say 10 million minus 5. Just short term is your current assets. Just do it that way. Okay, here we go. What do I mean by gains to leverage? What is the relate? Okay, again, here's a possible question. I'm going to give you 10 possible questions. What do I mean by gains to leverage? What is the relationship between internal rate of return and net present value? Write out your answer in your answers in complete sentences. Don't abbreviate. Use proper punctuation and grammar. I'm holding it to it tight. Again, another one. Selling stock is a bad idea. Why? Why is it a bad sign? I put it another way. Why is it a bad sign when a company is doing an IPO or another kind of public offering? Damn good question. No. An IPO? Well, one thing is, I am doing so damn well in this business. Here's on Craigslist. I really don't want to do it because this business of mine is so profitable, but I'm going to have to sell my ice cream truck business. I hate to, but I'm going to sell it. I'm going to sell a partnership. Half of my ice cream truck business. What do you say to someone who's going to sell you half of his business? You're doing bad, aren't you, son of a bitch? They need money. Apparently, they can't run their business on what they got, so they got to find a sucker to join them. That'd be one reason that it'd be bad. There are a couple of reasons. Okay. Even though dividends are really the company is giving up money that it could invest in projects, companies give dividends. Give two reasons, two theories as to why companies do it, even though it doesn't seem logical. Give two theories about why companies issue dividends, even though it doesn't seem logical to do it. What is a Form 8K? You said, duh. What is a Form 8K? Form 8K. What is a Form 10K? Why does the cost of capital rise? What is the weighted average? What is meant by the optimal capital structure? What is meant by the optimal capital structure? Remember, that's a technical thing, and you should have a picture that I drew. It should look like a parabola or like a horseshoe. The optimal capital structure is definitionally a place on that graph. You should find it in your notes somewhere. try a couple more here before we end this class. Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, wow, I didn't know I asked something that hard. Sorry. That's insensitive. What is the relationship between break even unit price, unit variable cost, and fixed costs? What is the relationship between break even, unit price, unit variable cost, and fixed cost? And the way you would answer that is, as fixed costs increase, break-even output level goes up. As price increases, break-even output level goes down. And as unit variable cost increases, your break-even output level goes up. That's all I'm asking for. That's not as tough as it sounds. You just explain what each one would do to your break-even output level.
Can you repeat that?
Not the whole damn thing. The fixed costs, increasing fixed costs make the break-even go up. Price increasing makes it go down. And variable costs increasing makes it go up. Okay, that's enough. Study hard. Talk to you on Thursday.